This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman, and here are some of the latest developments in the global coronavirus crisis. Tokyo reported a record rise in coronavirus cases on Saturday as Japan experiences a surge that now includes a new fast-spreading strain. Japan has also decided to ban all new entries of foreign nationals from December 28th to the end of January, following the detection of the new virus variant in arrivals from Britain. South Korea posted its second highest daily number of coronavirus cases on Saturday as outbreaks at a prison, nursing homes, and churches continued to grow, prompting authorities to plead for a halt to all year-end gatherings. Sydney residents were urged not to head to the shops for Boxing Day bargains, while those in some northern beach suburbs prepared to re-enter a strict lockdown for 3 days from Sunday as the Australian city seeks to stamp out a coronavirus outbreak. A fire killed at least 7 people and injured several others on Saturday at a private hospital that was treating coronavirus patients on the outskirts of the Egyptian capital, Cairo, local sources and media said. Iran has extended a nighttime traffic curfew to 330 lower-risk cities in an effort to sustain a recent fall in the number of new COVID-19 infections and deaths, state television reported on Saturday. And Russia on Saturday approved its main COVID-19 vaccine, Sputnik V, for use by people over the age of 60. Russian news agency cited the health ministry as saying people over 60 have thus far been excluded from Russia's national inoculation program as the shot was tested on this age group separately. The COVID-19 vaccine developed by China's Sinovac Biotech showed efficacy between 50 and 90%. This is VOA News. And here are some of the other stories making headlines around the globe today. The jobless benefits of millions of Americans expired on Saturday after U.S. President Donald Trump refused to sign into law a $2.3 trillion coronavirus pandemic aid and spending package, protesting that it did not do enough to help everyday people. The United Nations says that 3 of its peacekeepers have been killed by unidentified combatants in the Central African Republic as the country prepares for a general election and fighting continues between rebels and government forces. Britain is set for a new chapter after securing a hard-fought post-Brexit trade deal with the European Union. 10 out of 12 Hong Kong pro-democracy activists arrested as they tried to flee the territory by speedboat to Taiwan will face trial in mainland China on December 28th. This is according to campaigners and family members. Hundreds of trucks arrive at the French port of Calais as authorities scramble to ease a bottleneck in Britain, where thousands of drivers have been stuck for days after France imposed tougher coronavirus rules. And in Uganda suspended all campaigning for January's presidential poll in the capital and 10 populous districts on Saturday, citing coronavirus risks. But critics said the real reason was, in fact, the opposition's popularity in these areas. The East African country is scheduled to hold a presidential election on January 14th. A spokesman for the Independent Electoral Commission said the suspensions are taking place in areas where there's a high spread of the coronavirus. Uganda has reported roughly 33,000 COVID-19 infections and 245 deaths from the virus since the pandemic began. Candidate and pop star Bobby Wine has emerged as the strongest challenger to President Yoweri Museveni. The president has been in power since 1986. Last month, 3 people died in protests that erupted after police arrested Wine while he was campaigning in the country's east for violating anti-coronavirus measures. Wine had several rallies scheduled this coming week as well. Ethiopia will hold legislative and regional elections on June 5th of next year, the Electoral Commission is saying, after polls scheduled for 2020 were delayed by the coronavirus pandemic. The canceled elections were a factor that stoked tensions between Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and the dissident Northern Tigray region. For more on these stories, please visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News. We'll be right back.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time magazine, Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. The United States Congress passed a pandemic relief package worth almost $1 trillion U.S. dollars that will deliver long-sought assistance to individuals and businesses. The wide-ranging bill still fell short of the Democrats' demands for funding, and President-elect Biden is already signaling his intention to provide a third round of assistance in the early days of his administration. Over 40 countries have imposed travel bans on people arriving from Britain after the government announced last week that it had detected a new, more contagious strain of the coronavirus. A more contagious strain was also detected in South Africa. Meanwhile, the European Union gave official approval for the coronavirus vaccine developed by BioNTech and Pfizer, while the United States began distributing a second COVID-19 vaccine developed by U.S. drug maker Moderna. U.S. lawmakers, including President-elect Biden, Vice President Mike Pence, and the leadership in the House of Representatives and Senate have already received vaccinations. A massive hack of U.S. government agencies and private companies is being called unprecedented in its size and scope, with security experts pointing to Russia as the culprit. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and Attorney General William Barr said Russia appears to be responsible, and leaders in both political parties called for a strong response from the White House. However, President Donald Trump disputed the severity of the breach and Russia as the responsible party. And in a tumultuous start to the final month of his administration, President Trump continued his attempts to undermine and reverse the results of the 2020 election, with Trump loyalists suggesting that he impose martial law to enforce new elections in swing states that he lost despite the Electoral College declaring Biden the winner. Finally, Trump announced his latest round of presidential pardons, which included two men convicted of lying to Special Prosecutor Robert S. Mueller and four government contractors convicted in connection with the killing of Iraqi citizens. Panelists, welcome. And it's just a completely packed show today, so we'll try to get right to it. I wanted to start with the COVID relief package. Congress passed a $900 billion pandemic relief package that will deliver long-sought cash to Americans. It's a massive document, some 5,600 pages, my sources say, is one of the largest, if not the largest, bill in writing that they've ever seen come through from the Congress. It has some essential items such as direct payments and extended unemployment benefits. It also excludes some items that both parties had fought for. Molly, I'll start with you. What are the most critical items that are included and what was left out that each side wanted?
Yeah, well, as you mentioned, the biggest headline in this bill is the money for ordinary Americans to help take the edge off all of the disruptions and suffering that COVID has caused in the economy. So at first, the lawmakers were not talking about further direct payments. Instead, they were simply going to extend the enhanced unemployment insurance that was provided earlier in the year. But there was a sort of confluence of interesting political coalitions where some populist Republicans such as Josh Hawley and left-wing Democrats such as Bernie Sanders were together advocating for these direct payments to be part of the bill. And the White House also was said to have wanted that. There is an extension of that enhanced unemployment insurance, not the $600 per week that was in earlier packages, but about $300 per week. Some other provisions targeted toward COVID, money for things like vaccines and vaccine distribution, some more small business aid, forgivable loans to small businesses to help them stay afloat since so many have had to close. And then there's some stuff that's unrelated or tangentially related to COVID, yeah, as tends to happen in these big sort of Christmas tree bills that Congress passed. And this was all done as a package with the annual spending bill that also needed to be passed to keep the government open. As you mentioned, there were some things that both sides wanted and had to give up. For Republicans, it was the idea of liability protections for businesses, which was something that the Senate leader, Mitch McConnell, had called a red line earlier, but eventually gave up in negotiations. And for Democrats, it was aid to state and local governments whose revenues have seen a big hit from COVID at the same time as they are providing so many public services to help people get through it. But state and local governments will get funding in some other areas from other parts of the bill, such as funding for schools that is in this bill separately. So it's a big bill, not as big as some wanted, but it does represent a bipartisan compromise. And everything seemed fine until at the 11th hour, the president decided to cannonball into the pool and declare that he was not happy with this negotiation that he really had not been a significant part of.
Abdur-Rahim, Republicans and Democrats are blaming each other for a delay in this bill. I think very few people, if any, thought it would be this long before relief was distributed by Congress to the ordinary American during this pandemic. They're blaming each other. Are they both right? Are both sides to blame?
I think they are. It has to be said for people, obviously, who don't know how big of a deal Christmas is in the United States. Traditionally, Christmas is a big deal, even in normal times. But there's absolutely nothing normal about the times we're going through now with COVID-19 and possibly its mutant variant of it, and the kind of suffering that COVID-19 has imposed on Americans, both in terms of sickness, lives, economic difficulty. And you have members of Congress who've been bickering about this for months through the suffering of a lot of Americans, a lot of American families, a lot of American businesses. And I find it extraordinary that $600, the checks that Americans are supposed to receive, $600 could be a lot of money for a lot of families. But I still find it, you know, extraordinary that both parties have been bickering about this. And now, after they reached this bill, there's talk about, well, you know, the Republicans never told us that the president would be okay with $2,000 as the amount of the check, as the Democrats are now saying. $600 is a lot of money. $2,000 could be even a bigger help, obviously. But 2 days before Christmas, it's still not sure where the whole situation is headed. Will Americans receive $600 or $2,000 or nothing at all? We don't know at this point, with the president having taken the line that he's taken. We don't know if he's going to veto. We don't know if he vetoed, what complexity overriding the veto would involve. Both Republicans and Democrats passed this with comfortable majorities in both houses. But there's no guarantee that the comfort around overriding the veto would still be there if it came to it.
Molly, you mentioned the president weighing into these negotiations. He has been noticeably absent through the entire process. And now it seems as though he's putting out a fire with a can of gasoline here. So what does he hope to achieve by these proposals on this legislation, making the statement that the bill is a disgrace and the bill is outrageous and unsuitable? Does he really expect to get the changes that he's asking for? Or is this yet another political ploy to, in essence, drum up support for his desire to stay in office?
You know, it's always a risky proposition to try to discern Donald Trump's motivations, but it really does appear to be nothing deeper than a desire for attention. You know, as you said, the president has been disengaged with this process, not just this negotiation, but the entire process of COVID relief, you know, starting when the two parties in Congress started working on emergency legislation back in February. From time to time, he would wade into this debate with conflicting messages, sometimes saying he was for something, sometimes saying he was against it, sometimes urging the parties to come together and negotiate without at all specifying what he wanted to see in the bill, and then sometimes declaring, you know, that he was walking away from the table. So he hasn't at all been a constructive presence in these talks, and he's been pretty disengaged, particularly since the election, from anything having to do with COVID. So it is quite true that neither party had any idea, and the White House itself, and, you know, the president's negotiator on this bill was the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin. He did not know that the president was going to put out this statement, or that the president was displeased with the place that the negotiators ended up. It was a very difficult negotiation, very polarized and partisan Congress. They were finally able to get to this point and get something that could pass both houses. And at that point, Trump seems to have realized that this was all done without him being a part of the negotiations. And he seems to have seized on some sort of misleading right-wing tweets having to do with the amount of foreign aid, not in the relief package, but in the overall spending bill, to declare that there was, you know, waste and bad spending in the bill, at the same time as he's calling for more spending for the checks for Americans. So it will be a really interesting test now that Trump is on his way out of office. Do Republicans, are they still afraid of him in the same way? Will they still do his bidding simply because he says so, even when they clearly would like to go home and celebrate Christmas with their families instead.
Indeed. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Molly Ball, National Political Correspondent for Time Magazine. Abdulrahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's Regional Director for the Americas, and our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. The COVID-19 update, it was a mixed bag of news regarding the pandemic as Germany, Belgium, France, and Canada were among the 40 countries that imposed travel bans on people arriving from Britain after the British government announced that last week it had detected a new, more contagious strain of the virus. The World Health Organization says that it's also studying variants of the coronavirus that was found in Britain and South Africa, adding that there is no evidence that they are deadlier or more severe than the more common strains. And again, the best thing that people can do is to work to suppress transmission through mask wearing, social distancing, and hand washing. I'll start with you, Abdulrahim. What are doctors saying about the new strains of the coronavirus? And does this discovery of the new strain represent a new threat and even a setback in the battle against the pandemic?
The doctors are saying, with the initial panic that came with the news that the variant was discovered in the UK and that many countries have basically stopped flying to and from the UK, there came a silver lining with specialists like Dr. Fauci saying that they do not necessarily believe that this could be a worse form of the virus than the COVID-19. I think us here in the United States, if one can talk of a silver lining, I don't know to what extent it is a silver lining, but to the extent that people were gearing up for Christmas and that Dr. Fauci, the administration of Donald Trump, the team of President-elect Joe Biden have all been calling for people to be extra cautious. All the talk about locking down some parts of the economy in various parts of the United States, I guess that has cushioned the panic that would otherwise have come with the news of this new variant of COVID-19 to the United States. So the country would have called for extra caution no matter what. The fact that the news has coincided with Christmas, I guess, is the silver lining, because at least psychologically, it helps contain the fear and the panic.
Molly, a famous novel begins, "It was the best of times, it was the worst of times." And that seems to be an apt description of what we get when pandemic news these days, when we see record numbers of positive cases being recorded, record numbers of deaths, hospitals being strained to the limit. And at the same time, we see, again, a second vaccine being approved and being distributed within the United States. I want to ask you sort of about the politics of the distribution of the vaccine. We see that the CDC recommends that first responders, more vulnerable populations are vaccinated first. But we also see at the same time, President-elect Biden, Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, Senate Leader McConnell, and other electeds jump to the head of the line to be vaccinated. We also see coronavirus deniers like Marco Rubio and Lindsey Graham getting early vaccinations. What's the importance of the opticals of this? Is it reasonable and correct for our elected officials to jump to the head of the line? And is there a backlash against those getting vaccinated who have been deniers and in some cases spreaders of the virus itself?
I don't know that any of those, I would call those politicians deniers. I mean, they certainly acknowledge the existence and severity of the coronavirus, even if they may have disagreed with aspects of, you know, the experts' recommendations for the response. But look, there is, as you know, there's an obvious tension here, because on the one hand, the supply of the vaccine is limited and governments have to decide how to prioritize different populations as they get those limited doses out to the public. On the other hand, there's a lot of skepticism of vaccines, both the vaccines in general from this, you know, anti-scientific, anti-vaccination movement that has spread so vastly in the United States in recent years and has done so much damage. And also this specific vaccine, I think there's skepticism around, partly because there's been so much disinformation and misinformation around COVID overall, and partly because the Trump administration in the United States and other governments around the world have not necessarily inspired great public trust with the way that they have both handled the COVID-19 response and put out information about it. So these elected officials, as they presented, they're not trying to get something that other people can't have in order to sort of hog it for themselves. They're trying to demonstrate to people that this is safe. They're trying to provide assurances to Americans who may be worried about whether it's okay to get this vaccine, that this is something they should trust and it is something they should want to do. So they're trying to set a good example and say, if your turn comes up on the list, please do get the vaccine, because everybody who's eligible needs to get it as soon as possible in order for society to be able to further reopen and return to normal.
And health professionals have also said that even with getting a vaccine, people should maintain social distancing and also engage in mask wearing. So we'll see if those politicians who have taken the vaccine will also follow up on points 2 and 3 and be consistent and send positive messages in that way. Let's move on to the U.S. hacking issue, a massive hack of U.S. systems that raised alarms across the government and the private sector. This from an NBC News report. U.S. officials are deeply concerned about a massive and ongoing cyber attack targeting large companies and U.S. agencies, including the Treasury and Commerce Department. The Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency called the attack a grave risk to national security. Secretary Pompeo and William Barr have said Russia appears to be responsible. Russia, of course, denies any involvement, and President Trump seems to be of a completely different mind about what happened and who done it. Abdur-Rahim, what do we know about who was affected? And there is a general consensus that Russia is responsible for this, am I right?
There is. Members of Congress, many of them agree that it was Russia. Lots of private companies involved do believe that it was Russia. Mike Pompeo said in an interview that he believed it was Russia behind the cyber attack. Although in the same interview, it has to be said, he did say that he thinks China is an existential threat to the United States. But obviously, President Trump captured the headlines. He captured everybody's attention when he said that it's not Russia. It may be China who is behind the attack. That obviously has raised a lot of old questions, the old skeletons about why is the president always trying to, as his critics say, defend Russia. So there's a quasi consensus that it was Russia in Washington, that it was Russia behind the attack. But we don't know that for sure. There were members of Congress who even went so far as to say that what happened was a declaration of war. But we heard from Joe Biden, the president-elect, he didn't go so far as to call it a declaration of war. We've seen some catchy editorials in like the one in the Washington Post by David Ignatius saying also that he doesn't think that it was a declaration of war. It was part of espionage that usually goes on in the world, except that this is a massive scale. And I found it interesting that he compared the United States in terms of the internet to what Lebanon or Belgium are, as small countries where basically other people's fight their battles. Now, David Ignatius says that the United States is the internet territory, so to speak, where a lot of international powers are now fighting their battles. Obviously, what happens in the United States doesn't stay in the United States. I mean, the United States has a lot of cyber relations with a lot of its allies around the world, and many of its allies use software and infrastructure basically made in the U.S. and shared with them by the U.S. So there's a lot of concern around the world as well.
Indeed. Molly, some are calling this a hack, while others, like Democratic Senator Dick Durbin, are calling it an attack. And I believe he used the description of the attack being akin to Pearl Harbor. An attack demands a response. And my question to you is that response likely to come from the Trump administration during these last days of that administration, or is that response going to have to wait for the incoming Biden administration?
I think it's clear that it's going to fall to the next administration to straighten out the very tangled morass of Russia policy in the United States. And it's going to be a really interesting area to see how President-elect Biden decides to handle Russia. You know, back when Biden was vice president under President Obama, a lot of Republicans were critical of the administration for not being harder on Russia and not dealing more forcefully with Vladimir Putin. Fast forward to the Trump administration, that's not a very common Republican criticism because, as Abdul-Rahim was saying, the president has been so reluctant to criticize Russia and Putin in particular for reasons that appear, again, to be personal sort of ego-related motivations on Trump's part, having to do with his sensitivities over the Russian interference in the 2016 election, which every American intelligence agency has corroborated, and the only person in the government who appears not to believe it is the president. As you said, it does matter how we look at these kinds of maneuvers. It is both an attack, it's a cyber attack, and it is a hack. That's the way these things are done. But because the president appears so invested in wishing away these kinds of attacks, it's clear that the next administration is going to have to take on both the logistical response in terms of how to protect the American government from these kinds of attacks, figure out how the attackers were able to penetrate these systems and try to shore them up, and then the diplomatic response, whatever types of sanctions or other potential responses the new administration is going to try to levy on Russia in retaliation for this. And it's going to be a very delicate and difficult area of American foreign policy that's going to be, I think, on the front burner of the many, many diplomatic crises that the next president faces.
I want to finish with sort of get some broad thoughts from you. You had meetings in the White House to discuss imposing martial law, something we've never seen in a modern White House. We have the White House considering installing fringe elements as special counsels to investigate the election that was called by professionals the safest and most secure in American history. And then there was a slew of pardons that include a veritable rogues gallery of cronies, corrupt politicians, and war criminals. Molly, let's start with this martial law idea. Michael Flynn, who was former national security advisor, now a convicted perjurer, convicted and pardoned, I should say, by President Trump, and others were in the White House asking the president to declare martial law. This from reports. How far in your reporting has the discussion gone? Is it still being considered?
Yes and no. I mean, it's an idea that the president likes because it's being dangled in front of him by these basically irresponsible charlatans who want him to believe that he continue to stay in power when that is absolutely not the case. These types of anti-democratic maneuvers are really a threat to our democratic system, and they're being enabled by these sort of fringe elements. As you mentioned, you know, even people like Attorney General Bill Barr, who have shown themselves willing to do the president's bidding in a lot of ways that trouble outside observers, even they have sought to get as far away from these kinds of suggestions as possible. And you hear a lot of alarm from the people who are still left in the administration at the lengths to which the president appears willing to take this. I don't think there's any chance that any of this actually happens, but just the fact that the president is indulging, you know, the insane conspiracy theories like those being promulgated by the attorney Sidney Powell. It just can't be emphasized enough that the things that they're saying about problems with the election aren't true. They are feeding the president lies, and he is eagerly lapping them up because he wants to believe that there's some chance that he can somehow overturn the legitimate result of this free and fair election.
Abdul-Rahim, I want to finish with you on the point that Molly just made.
Quickly, let me say, it seems to me that whatever he does now, whatever he says, is not going to change the outcome that Joe Biden will become the next president of the United States. But like Molly said, although they're not likely to pan out in anything practical for him or for the rest of the United States, these are very significant developments, whether in the specific context of U.S. democracy or in the specific, in the general context of what the U.S. means to the rest of the world. There are obviously jokes around places like the Middle East that, you know, President Trump has been so buddy-buddy with dictators and military regimes in some parts of the world like the Middle East that he's becoming a bird of a feather. People following this, whether you're talking about the issue of declaring martial law or politicizing the amnesty for the people that he's amnestied now, as I said, dictators and military regimes around the world, they've just gone to town over. They've basically saying, look, if the United States of America can do this, we can do it too.
There's so much more to talk about on all of these topics, but unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this week. Thanks to our panelists, Molly Ball, national political correspondent for Time Magazine, and Abdul-Rahim Fukara, Al Jazeera's regional director for the Americas. This program is produced by The Voice of America. I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, Jill Robbins and I tell you about a recent opinion story in an American newspaper. Later, Jill Robbins answers a question from an English learner in China. We close with an American story. This week, it is Quiche by Jack London. But first, the next First Lady of the United States, Jill Biden, holds a doctorate in education. She completed her degree from the University of Delaware in 2007. When President-elect Joe Biden takes office next month, Jill Biden will be the first ever First Lady with a doctoral degree. She is widely known as Dr. Jill Biden. This is not unusual. In English, the word doctor can appear before the name of a person who holds a doctoral degree or a medical degree. But a recent opinion article published in the Wall Street Journal newspaper disagreed with the custom. The title of the article, by American writer Joseph Epstein, is There a Doctor in the White House? Not if you need an M.D. M.D. is short for a doctor of medicine.
Epstein begins his article like this. Madam First Lady, Mrs. Biden, Jill, kiddo, a bit of advice on what may seem like a small, but I think is not an unimportant matter. Any chance you might drop the doctor before your name? Epstein argues that Jill Biden does not deserve to be called Dr. Biden because she is not a medical doctor. He notes, a wise man once said that no one should call himself doctor unless he has delivered a child. Reaction to the article came quickly. Supporters of Epstein's argument agreed that people with teaching degrees should not want people to call them doctor. One conservative television presenter, Tucker Carlson, said Dr. Biden is as much of a doctor as Dr. Pepper is. Dr. Pepper is a popular brand of soft drink. Critics of Epstein's article, however, expressed surprise that the Wall Street Journal let such a story be published. They said they found it to be offensive, sexist, and, more simply, pointless.
In a post on Instagram, former First Lady Michelle Obama wrote, "Right now, we are all seeing what happens to so many professional women, whether their titles are Dr., Ms., Mrs., or even First Lady. All too often, our accomplishments are met with skepticism, even derision." Another former First Lady, Hillary Clinton, used fewer words. She tweeted, "Her name is Dr. Jill Biden. Get used to it." Vice President-elect Kamala Harris reacted to the article during a television appearance this week, saying, "It's not the American way." Jill Biden offered her own response Thursday, when she and President-elect Biden appeared on The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. She said the Epstein article surprised her. She said her doctoral degree is one of the things that she is proud of. She added, "I worked so hard for it." Around the world, social media users who hold doctoral degrees in fields such as history, education, and mathematics changed their Twitter names to include Doctor.
In professional situations, it is correct to use the title Doctor for medical doctors, as well as for people who have earned doctoral degrees. The lowercase form of the word doctor is only used to describe a person who is trained and licensed to treat sick and injured people. Jill Biden's students called her Dr. B. At political events, she is introduced as Dr. Jill Biden. Her Twitter account is at Dr. Biden. The general belief is that anyone who has earned a doctoral degree has the right to have the honorific doctor before their name. But what about in other languages?
Many are similar to English. In Spanish, for example, doctor is used for people with medical degrees and doctoral degrees in other fields. Claudia Bautista, a VOA Learning English listener from Mexico City, explains. In my city, the governor-in-chief is Doctora Claudia Sheinbaum. All people, colleagues, news, call her Doctora Sheinbaum. She is a politician, activist, writer, and scientist with a doctoral degree. That's why we call her Doctor or Doctora. In Spanish, the feminine form of doctor is doctora. It is much the same in Turkish, as VOA Learning English listener Cem Utkan explains. Doctor is placed before the names of people who have completed their doctorate education and have the title of doctor, Utkan said. The same word is also used for medical doctors.
Some languages, such as Vietnamese and Chinese, use different honorifics for the two kinds of doctors. San Dao, a listener from Vietnam whose second language is English, explains. Vietnamese uses Bác sĩ, doctor, to address medical doctors who work in hospitals, dentists, or maybe veterinarians or physicians. But one point worth saying is that Bác sĩ is not an honorific for those who have completed their PhD. A PhD holder is called Tiến sĩ, which can be clearly distinguished from Bác sĩ. San adds, I believe everyone knows the next First Lady is not a medical doctor, so there's no point in clarifying it.
As Epstein's opinion article and reaction to it went viral, the American dictionary Merriam-Webster offered a bit of language history. It wrote on Twitter, the word doctor comes from the Latin word for teacher. You probably already know that VOA Learning English has a Dr. Jill of its own. That would be language learning specialist Jill Robbins, who earned a doctorate in applied linguistics from Georgetown University. Around the office, when we are there, many of us call her Dr. Jill. Yet it is VOA's own writing style, and the writing style of most American news organizations, to only use doctor before someone's name if they are a medical doctor. That is why we call the nation's top infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci, but do not use the honorific doctor when writing about Jill Biden. I'm Ashley Thompson.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
Thank you. To help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int, or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
Next up is this week's Ask a Teacher.
Today, we answer a question from Ryan in China. He writes, "When I want to say no with more politeness, what are other expressions I can use? Here are some examples about the situation. When the teacher asks me, 'Do you have any questions?' Or when the flight attendant asks me, 'Do you need coffee?' 'Thanks, Ryan.' Dear Ryan, thank you for your question. Most Americans speak directly and are not afraid to say no in many situations. But we do have ways to be polite or show respect for another's feelings. The simplest way to be polite is to say no thank you. Let us look at some other polite ways to say no. In the case of a teacher asking, 'Do you have any questions?' you may want to answer this way:
'No, I do not have any, because your lesson was very clear.'
Another answer you may give is:
'Not now, but I might have some later when I try to do the assignment.'
This leaves open the possibility of asking questions on the subject later. On a plane, when a flight attendant asks, 'Do you need coffee?' you may hear this answer:
'Thanks, I'm fine.'
Note that the speaker does not use the word no, but still sends the message that coffee is not wanted. Another answer would suggest something else the attendant can bring:
'No thanks, but I would like some water.'
I think that saying no may be more difficult in other situations, such as when a friend asks you for a favor. In this case, Americans would usually explain why they cannot help. Here is an example:
'Ryan, can I borrow your bicycle tomorrow?'
'No, I'm sorry, but I need it to go to my job.'
It is also difficult to say no to an invitation. We might say we would like to accept it, to be polite. Listen to this example:
'Ryan, can you join us for dinner Saturday?'
'I wish I could, but I have other plans.'
Here, you express the idea that you want to accept the invitation, but you do not need to give details of your plan. I hope this helps the next time you want to give a polite answer to a question, Ryan. And that's Ask a Teacher. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Jill Robbins.
Our story this week is Quiche. It was written by Jack London. Here is Shep O'Neill to tell you the story.
Kish lived at the edge of the polar sea. He had seen 13 suns in the Eskimo way of keeping time. Among the Eskimos, the sun each winter leaves the land in darkness. And the next year, a new sun returns, so it might be warm again. The father of Kish had been a brave man, but he had died hunting for food. Kish was his only son. Kish lived alone with his mother, Ikiga. One night, the village council met in the big igloo of Kloshkwan, the chief. Kish was there with the others. He listened, then waited for silence. He said, "It is true that you give us some meat, but it is often old and tough meat and has many bones." The hunters were surprised. This was a child speaking against them. A child talking like a grown man. Kish said, "My father, Bok, was a great hunter. It is said that Bok brought home more meat than any of the two best hunters, and that he divided the meat so that all got an equal share." "Nah, nah," the hunters cried. "Put the child out. Send him to bed. He should not talk to graybeards this way." Kish waited until the noise stopped. "You have a wife, Ugluk," he said, "and you speak for her. My mother has no one but me, so I speak. As I say, Bok hunted greatly, but is now dead. It is only fair, then, that my mother, who was his wife, and I, his son, should have meat when the tribe has meat. I, Kish, son of Bok, have spoken." Again there was a great noise in the igloo. The council ordered Kish to bed. It even talked of giving him no food. Kish jumped to his feet. "Hear me," he cried. "Never shall I speak in the council igloo again. I shall go hunt meat like my father, Bok." There was much laughter when Kish spoke of hunting. The laughter followed Kish as he left the council meeting. The next day, Kish started out for the shore, where the land meets the ice. Those who watched saw that he carried his bow and many arrows. Across his shoulder was his father's big hunting spear. Again, there was laughter. One day passed, then a second. On the third day, a great wind blew. There was no sign of Kish. His mother, Ikiga, put burned seal oil on her face to show her sorrow. The women shouted at their men for letting the little boy go. The men made no answer, but got ready to search for the body of Kish. Early next morning, Kish walked into the village. Across his shoulders was fresh meat. "Go, you men, with dogs and sleds. Follow my footsteps. Travel for a day," he said. "There is much meat on the ice, a she-bear and her two cubs." His mother was very happy. Kish, trying to be a man, said to her, "Come, Ikiga, let us eat. And after that, I shall sleep, for I am tired." There was much talk after Kish went to his igloo. The killing of a bear was dangerous, but it was three times more dangerous to kill a mother bear with cubs. The men did not believe Quiche had done so, but the women pointed to the fresh meat. At last, the men agreed to go for the meat that was left, but they were not very happy. One said that even if Quiche had killed the bear, he probably had not cut the meat into pieces. But when the men arrived, they found that Quiche had not only killed the bear, but had also cut it into pieces, just like a grown hunter. So began the mystery of Quiche. On his next trip, he killed a young bear. And on the following trip, a large male bear and its mate. Then there was talk of magic and witchcraft in the village. "He hunts with evil spirits," said one. "Maybe his father's spirit hunts with him," said another. Quiche continued to bring meat to the village. Some people thought he was a great hunter. There was talk of making him chief after old Kloshkwan. They waited, hoping he would come to council meetings, but he never came. "I would like to build an igloo," Quiche said one day, "but I have no time. My job is hunting, so it would be just if the men and women of the village who eat my meat build my igloo." And the igloo was built. It was even bigger than the igloo of the chief, Kloshkwan. One day, Ugluk talked to Quiche. "It is said that you hunt with evil spirits, and they help you kill the bear." "Is not the meat good?" Quiche answered. "Has anyone in the village yet become sick after eating it? How do you know evil spirits are with me? Or do you say it because I am a good hunter?" Ugluk had no answer. The council sat up late talking about Quiche and the meat. They decided to spy on him. On Quiche's next trip, two young hunters, Beam and Bon, followed him. After 5 days, they returned. The council met to hear their story. "Brothers," Beam said, "we followed Quiche, and he did not see us. The first day he came to a great bear. Quiche shouted at the bear loudly. The bear saw him and became angry. It rose high on its legs and growled, but Quiche walked up to it." "We saw it," Bon, the other hunter, said. "The bear began to run toward Quiche. Quiche ran away. But as he ran, he dropped a little round ball on the ice. The bear stopped and smelled the ball, then ate it. Quiche continued to run, dropping more balls on the ice. The bear followed and ate the balls." The council members listened to every word. Beam continued the story. "The bear suddenly stood up straight and began to shout in pain." "Evil spirits," said Ugluk. "I do not know," said Bon. "I can tell only what my eyes saw." The bear grew weak. Then it sat down and pulled at its own fur with its sharp claws. Quiche watched the bear that whole day. For 3 more days, Quiche continued to watch the bear. It was getting weaker and weaker. Quiche moved carefully up to the bear and pushed his father's spear into it. "And then?" asked Kloshkwan. "And then we left." That afternoon, the council talked and talked. When Kish arrived in the village, the council sent a messenger to ask him to come to the meeting. But Kish said he was tired and hungry. He said his igloo was big and could hold many people if the council wanted a meeting. Klush Kwan led the council to the igloo of Kish. Kish was eating, but he welcomed them. Klush Kwan told Kish that two hunters had seen him kill a bear. And then, in a serious voice to Kish, he said, "We want to know how you did it. Did you use magic and witchcraft?" Kish looked up and smiled. "No, Klush Kwan, I am a boy. I know nothing of magic or witchcraft. But I have found an easy way to kill the ice bear. It is headcraft, not witchcraft." "And will you tell us, O Kish?" Klush Kwan asked in a shaking voice. "I will tell you. It is very simple. Watch." Kish picked up a thin piece of whalebone. The ends were pointed and sharp as a knife. Kish bent the bone into a circle. Suddenly, he let the bone go, and it became straight with a sharp snap. He picked up a piece of seal meat. "So," he said, "first make a circle with a sharp, thin piece of whalebone. Put the circle of bone inside some seal meat. Put it in the snow to freeze. The bear eats the ball of meat with the circle of bone inside. When the meat gets inside the bear, the meat gets warm, and the bone goes snap. The sharp points make the bear sick. It is easy to kill then. It is simple." Ugluk said, "Oh." Klush Kwan said, "Ah." Each said something in his own way, and all understood. That is the story of Kish, who lived long ago on the edge of the polar sea. Because he used headcraft instead of witchcraft, he rose from the poorest igloo to be the chief in the village. And for all the years that followed, his people were happy. No one cried at night with pains of hunger.
You have heard the story, Kish. It was written by Jack London. Your storyteller was Shep O'Neill.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.